good afternoon and welcome to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's program featuring our panel speaking on the topic of Election Watch 2024, journalistic experience from the global stage. My name is Christine Shea and I'm an ICFRC board member and I'll be your host for today's program. We are deeply grateful for the long-standing support from our community, many of whom are here with us today. Your help has allowed our organization to grow for 40 years, hosting speaker programs with experts joining us in person and online from across the world. As a small nonprofit, we exist because of the generosity of individuals like you. We also extend our heartfelt thanks to those joining us virtually or watching this program broadcast online on City Channel 4. You are an integral part of our broad, interconnected community. I do hope all of you will consider making a financial contribution today by scanning one of our QR codes in the room or visiting our website. These free programs are only possible because of your support. And finally, thank you to our sponsors and community partners for their support. In particular, today we recognize the Iowa City Public Library for their partnership and also for the refreshments served today. And a big thank you to the UI Center for Asian and Pacific Studies for sponsoring this program and supporting ICFRC's Democracy Series, as well as the Stanley Center for Peace for connecting us with the World Press Institute. So before we turn to the program, I would like to tell you about ICFRC's new Fall 2024 series, beginning today, Democracy at a Crossroads, Perspectives and Insights at Home and Around the World. We are really excited about this incredibly important 7-part series. The first 6 will precede the November elections, and the final program will be 2 weeks after. Do check out more information, including our full list of amazing sponsors on one of the flyers in the room, or again, on our website at icfrc.org. I will now turn things over to our executive director, Peter Gerlach.
Thank you very much. So I just want to take a few minutes of your time to welcome up here with me two folks who have agreed to help me with a short segment that we're doing for all of our Democracy Series programs. Vicky and JB, would you come on up? So at your tables in the center there, you can see that there is a stand. On one side, we've given you lots of information about our 7 programs, the 7 in the Democracy Series. So you can see when things are coming up. Of course, that information is also on our website. On the other side, you'll see some voting resources. We are, as you might imagine, very enthusiastically encouraging folks to get registered, to be informed about the candidates, and then, importantly, to vote if you are eligible to do so. So information can be found there as well as on our website. And I do hope sincerely that you engage and that you are a part of this very consequential election that's coming up. So as I noted, we are trying to involve as much as we can folks from sort of different social locations in Iowa, asking them 2 questions and giving them no more than 2 minutes each to, 1, what does democracy mean to you? And 2, why is it important in today's world? And so today we have Vicky from the League of Women Voters and JB from Hawk the Vote. So I'll turn it over to them so that they can give you their thoughts.
Okay, I'm Vicki Aden. I'm the president of the League of Women Voters of Johnson County. What does democracy mean to me? And I'll talk from sort of the lens of the League. So certainly democracy, we feel, is the best form of government because it allows the people who are being governed to have a say in what decisions are made for them. So, I'll check my notes because my memory is not what it used to be. So our organization works to empower voters with information and so that they can work to have a better democracy. Why is democracy important? Well, I think I said, obviously, having people, the more people that are involved in deciding who is going to represent them and what decisions made, the better off the country is. And certainly, having informed voters who can talk to candidates, make those decisions. That's why we go out and register voters. We provide them with information. We have candidate forums and legislative forums so people can talk directly to their representatives. And I think that's why it's important.
Awesome. Hi, everybody. My name is JB. I am the executive director for Hawk the Vote, which is the main student organization on campus responsible for voter participation and election participation in our local, state, and federal elections. And for me, again, speaking through the lens of my org, Hawk the Vote, I believe democracy is important, A, because it is an act. It is not something that we are granted or have infinite access to by any means. It is something that we have to participate in regularly and consistently in order to produce a net result that is positive. And that is important because when you have an organization like Talk the Vote who's dealing primarily with students, students have to realize and understand that they have a say and a foot in the door, in a sense, in making a change in the social issues and more physical issues as well around them. You know, students are certainly not trying to solve international geopolitics or anything like that. They're not dealing with democracy per se at that level. But we see students worried about rent costs or lighting downtown, housing security, things like that. And helping those students understand that your vote is in fact your voice is a very, very key tenet of the work that we do. And I would say that holds true for how I feel about democracy as well as how the organization does. And so, yeah, we're doing a lot of great work. We've registered over 1,000 new student voters in the first 4 weeks of campus, which is really, really exciting. And we are also right now teaching a first-of-its-kind academic course where students are getting academic credit for learning how to be essentially like organizers for a nonpartisan organization, how to register voters, turn in forms, all of that stuff. So active participation in democracy is a really big thing for us as well. Yeah.
Yeah, a hand for these two. Yeah, thank you both very much. Yeah. And of course, we have amazing organizations that are doing this really critical work, and we'd like to highlight them wherever we can. So as they reminded, please stay engaged, please become informed, and please, please vote. Christine?
All right, thank you, Peter. So I would now like to introduce our speakers. Our moderator for the panel today is Gugulethu Mufupi, who is a multi, yes, we can thank you, yes, welcome, thank you. Gugulethu is a multi-award winning financial journalist and radio broadcaster, and she's based in Johannesburg, South Africa. Her show, Kaya Biz, on Kaya 959, is a platform where she simplifies the world of business. She engages with corporate giants, policymakers, and up-and-coming entrepreneurs, providing a valuable platform for their voices. Gugulethu's invitation to guests to share their analysis of markets, corporate activity, and economics, along with discussions on personal finance and thought leadership, keeps the audience included and valued. Our panelists today, our first panelist is Anando Bakhto, and he is a New Delhi-based journalist covering India's opposition parties, national and provincial elections, and the Kashmir conflict. His in-depth reportage on the groundswell of Hindutva shed light on the ongoing ideological restructuring in India and its repercussions on minorities. In Kashmir, his stories highlight festering alienation under an iron fist bureaucratic power apparatus. Our second panelist is Haruna Ibrahim Kakangi, and he is a senior digital journalist working with the BBC in Abuja, Nigeria. He was inspired to work in the media to bring about positive change in society. Prior to this position, he worked as a senior journalist where he produced shows on accountability in Nigeria and on which political leaders are held to account for the promises they made during election campaigns. And our third panelist is Anabaso Reisman, and she is a data and political reporter for El Comercio newspaper in Lima, Peru. She occasionally contributes as a stringer for France 24 and has been an ICFJ and IJP fellow in the United States and Germany. Please join me in welcoming this amazing panel.
Thank you so much. Thank you kindly, Christine, for that wonderful introduction and welcome to myself as well as my colleagues. And thank you all, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us today. It's an absolute delight and a privilege to be in your presence here today, as many of you are participants in truly engaging, not only in themes around foreign policy, but beyond policy, we'll talk people. The fact that we gathered in this room here today allows us to interact directly and give you some perspective on the various countries, regions, and topics that we typically focus on as journalists from all over the world. Now, as Christine has so wonderfully done, she's introduced myself and the colleagues that I have with us as panelists on the table here today. But we certainly are not alone. Many of you would be well aware that the WPI is a very important organization. The World Press Institute essentially has a fellowship program of which we are the 59th cohort, coming from all spheres of the globe to essentially participate in not only distilling factors that have led to the evolution of media and journalism in the world, but also prioritizing how it is that we focus on media freedom, the role that media continues to play so critically in societies, providing education, knowledge, and insight, but also ensuring that we fully comprehend the new aspects of artificial intelligence, technology, and new concerns that might face the media and journalism profession. But beyond that, we are well aware that we also are in a year that has been characterized by elections for at least 60% of the world's population. Many of us here in the room have either gone to the polls or are headed there. So today we will be focused as well on how it is that the WPI as an organization, together with the various stakeholder engagements that we'll be having, are not only focused on broadening the aspects on conversations around media and media freedom, but also understanding how this continues to play a critical role in driving the themes and conversations around democracy. Before we do take introductions from some of my peers and colleagues, I also want to take this opportunity to extend our gratitude and thanks to those who continue to support the WPI through its ongoing efforts. So to Keith and Krista from the Stanley Center for joining us today, as well as coordinating the Iowa trip that we have, we'd really like to acknowledge you and your presence and participation. A round of applause to them, please. And Devin. Fantastic. And of course, Peter and Christine of the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council also for having us here and arranging this particular conversation today. We have about 45 minutes for our panel discussion, but it would not be a panel discussion without the inclusion of our peers and counterparts from across the world. 10 journalists arrived in the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul on the 6th of September. That's about 2 weeks ago. So we've had an experience and a half in the last 2 weeks of really seeing a few of the sights and sounds of the Midwest, from Grand Marais, the Twin Cities, and now here within Iowa City. So I'm going to request that my peers do join me in introducing themselves. I am aware that Peter had a roving mic available. Peter, if you are present, if the mic is available, or perhaps if we can have everyone at the podium. I'm conscious time. So what we will do is just kindly request that all of my colleagues who are part of the WPI Fellowship actually perhaps then make their way to the podium. And I would suggest that we all stand up at the same time so that we can have a quick introduction, 30 seconds of all the various fellows who will be joining us from all countries. Christina, if you could join us to make sure that we have some introductions from all the participants on stage. So if you could all be on the side of the lectern and the podium, and of course allowing each other a 30-second introduction, and from there, each particular speaker will then be seated. So to the audience, these are my colleagues. We've gotten to know each other very well over the last 2 weeks, but we still have another 7 weeks odd ahead of us where we will be traveling to other parts of the United States. Think D.C., Chicago, New York, Arizona, and a few other states, but so far we've been in the Midwest, and I must tell you, it's been fantastic getting an opportunity to experience the life of Americans, especially in this part of the world. So firstly, thank you for your hospitality, and I say this that we can also be kind and gentle to my colleagues who will be joining us in the front, introducing themselves, their backgrounds, the organizations that they work with, as a one-minute introduction, including the various countries that they're from. We'll start with my good friend from Kosovo.
Thank you, Gugu. Thank you so much. Hello, everyone. My name is Cemal Direja. I'm a freelance journalist and the head of the Association of Journalists of Kosovo. Very excited to be part of this year's WPI program with our colleagues from all around the world, and very excited and happy to be in Iowa, which holds a very special place in our hearts in Kosovo because of the great partnership we have. Kosovo and Iowa are sister states because of the great engagement of Iowa National Guard in developing Kosovo Army capacities and other spheres. So we're very thankful to that and looking forward to speak to you. Thanks.
Fantastic.
Hello, I am Sanna and I am from Finland, Helsinki. I work for Finland's national news agency, STT, which is like a Finnish version of like Associated Press, just a much smaller audience, I would say. I cover very much political news and also foreign news, and it's very great to be here and see all the different sides of the American life. We have already learned so much, and it's very interesting with the election coming since Finland and United States became very close last year where Finland joined NATO. So we are looking your elections with a big interest regarding that. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Luciana from Brazil. I work as a business and financial reporter for O Estado de São Paulo, which is one of the most important Brazilian newspapers. And I'm very happy and excited to be here in Iowa, as it's one of the most, the biggest ethanol producer and corn producer, which is like a, something that we also have in Brazil, and it's very important for our economy nowadays.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for having us here. I'm Ralit Fichova from Bulgaria. In the past 3 years and a half, I've been working as a political reporter for Economedia, which is the largest business outlet in my country. My country is going through a political crisis, and in the past 3 years, we had six elections, and we are heading towards our seventh governmental elections. So, yeah, very tough year. I'm really excited to be here to have the chance to explore America from different angles, to meet different people from different fields and businesses. So thank you for having us here and being able to join your community.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Cesare. I am an Italian journalist based in Rome. I'm working for the digital Italian newspaper today.it. I'm covering politics and economic. For 3 years, I've been a political fact checker, so it's a special period for me being here. I'm so grateful to WordPress Institute and also to you. Thanks to you for your warm welcome. It's a unique point of view covering the presidential race from the field, from the ground. And it will be a very exciting time, and I hope today we will exchange our points of views and experiences. Thank you very much.
And I'm the last one, but not least, Christina from Ukraine. It's a great opportunity for all of us, I think, to be here in during such an important moment for, I think, all the American people. As you know, the US is the main military donor for Ukraine. That's why it's a great opportunity also for me to be here and to know more about US politics from inside, being here in the United States and covering also the election results on November 5th. I'm working as a foreign policy journalist for the last 13 years, and for the last 5 years for the biggest Ukrainian TV channel, 1+1. And summarizing, I want to say that Gugu today has a birthday.
Oh.
So let's wave it in. Thank you.
You, we all became very familiar, right? So these are my friends, not just colleagues. So thank you so much to my colleagues for introducing themselves, and thank you as well for keeping an open mind in terms of the conversations that we are going to have and how they do reflect on the importance of democracy, which has been highlighted, the role within which media plays in that regard, and of course learning a lot more about countries that some of us might or might not be familiar with. I must say, as I walked into the room, just before we get into our first question, I looked at the flags on the table and very quickly tried to identify my home country's flag. I don't see it here, but what this does afford us an opportunity to do, oh, there we have one. And I think this is refreshing because for many of us as the fellows as well, it affords us the opportunity to look around the room and see just how integrated we are as a world and as a society. And this is a true representation of where we all are, most importantly within the U.S., how the U.S. as a key player, not only in terms of democracy, but world trade and economics, continues to prioritize the role in its relationship with many other nations and regions. So it is refreshing that we have this representation that is present in the room, not only through the flags, but of course the partnerships and the conversations we'll be having. As has been highlighted, the theme that has been set forward by the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council is one centered around democracy. For all of us, we've had the opportunity to actually witness what democracy looks like in our home countries. I come from South Africa, a country that has only experienced 30 years of democracy, and in our most recent elections, we've seen a shift in terms of the political powers. This is on the back of a heightened level of frustration that's been shared by voters, many of whom who have gone to the polls to let their voices be heard, and as such, has led to the very first time where we don't have one political party winning an outright majority. As such, we have what is called a government of national unity, multi-party leadership, which is really a shift in terms of the political leadership in South Africa, but also its impact and consequences on policies and the business environment. One of our partners in terms of global trade is not only the United States, but also the BRICS region of countries. India is one of those countries within BRICS. My colleague to my left, Anando, is from India. And Anando, we've had the fortunate opportunity of not only engaging in some of the themes that relate to trade and partnership between South Africa, India, and of course the United States, but also understanding how democracy has become a lot more vibrant within our local homesteads based on the fact that we've had recent elections. I'm keen for you to reflect on the elections that were recently held in India, what kind of outcomes we've seen, and how media has played a critical role in sharing feedback and outcomes to these conversations.
Thank you, Google. Is it on?
It is on.
Yeah.
I believe so. Is it on? Can you all hear him?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
First of all, a note of gratitude to the World Press Institute for bringing us to the nerve centers of America in an election year, a high-stakes election year, and in the electrifying company of 9 distinguished fellows. Thanks also to Stanley Center and Iowa Foreign Relations Council for organizing this talk today, which I hope will be engaging and edifying. Now, talking about democracy, Gugu used the word vibrant. Well, that's definitely what we all desire, but sadly that is not the case, especially in many developing countries and increasingly in developed countries also. A democracy is vibrant when you have subaltern perspectives and representation in the national conversation and in leadership, but that is increasingly not the case in India, unfortunately. We just had our national elections, and I would say that when you talk of local issues in order to make democracy representative, which is the purpose of democracy, many of you would be surprised to know that in India, in the past decade, more than 100,000 farmers died by suicide because they were trapped in debt cycles they could not endure. 35 farmers die by suicide in India every day. We just had a year-long farmers' protests, and which was brutally curbed by the police and even more indignantly suppressed and dismissed by a large section of the media. Now, that would lead you to imagine that perhaps Mr. Narendra Modi's regime in India is encountering a determined political backlash by the agrarian community. But that is hardly the case. And that might surprise you that Mr. Modi's party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, did exceedingly well in the farmers' belts of Malwa Nimar and also in provinces which have high concentration of farmers. So this is a contradiction. Mm-hmm. And there are two reasons for that. A, a politics of economic incentivization. So you distribute subsidized water, subsidized electricity, free ration, and that's enough to buy the loyalty of very impoverished people without really tracing the root causes of poverty and doing anything to alleviate that. Second is Mr. Modi's rags to riches story, which is very convincing. Now, in a country which has had dynasties, where people have seen dynasties having a long shot at power, his ascension as the prime minister is seen as a departure from the tradition of entitlement. So a lot of poor people relate to him, even when he is hand in gloves with the biggest corporates and there is hardly any articulation on corporate social responsibility. Politicization of national security issues and strengthening commitment to placing the social and political priorities of the majority Hindi community on the top are also ingredients of politics, but that means that his personality cult gives him great dividends in elections, but that also leads to deflection from local issues, which makes democracy less representative and defeats the purpose.
And what you're highlighting here, Anando, really gives us some insight into perhaps the news flow, access to information, and how that perhaps might see the distorted results we see when it comes to elections and political results. This highlights the important role that media and journalism plays, right, in sharing a lot more information with the public. Share with us in your experience as a representative of the media in India, perhaps just the level of ongoing access to adequate to information, which is easily accessible for even those who might be within the agricultural space.
That again is the desired role for the media persons. That's what we all expect the media to be, watchdogs against the government. But again, in India, right now, a large section of the media are acting as extended arms of the government. So the role of the media, it seems today, is to give political succor and legitimacy to the Hindu nationalist policies of Mr. Narendra Modi. As I just mentioned, that when we had a year-long farmers' agitation, it was not only brutally repressed by the police, but even a large section of the media delegitimized it. There is a tendency to depict any public protest in India, any expression of civilian dissent in India, as a threat to national security, and that's really the creation of the media. They also routinely vilify political opponents of Mr. Modi. There is a tendency to depict the opposition as a leaderless muddle who cannot be trusted to formulate a coherent national program and run the government. So the media, in fact, is giving succor to Mr. Modi's regime and ensuring that he stays in power for longer than he deserves. So it is not the right role the media is playing. Does that mean that we do not have free and fair media in India at all? We do have. There is a distinguished repository of online news channels, news portals, and few exception in newspapers too, like the Hindu group with which I have been associated. But then the government has a whole repressive armory of tactics to silence the press and push people into self-censorship because it's a very, very restrictive environment today under Mr. Modi.
We'll take a few more questions on that a little later when the audience is invited to participate in a Q&A, a question and answer session. I'm keen to shift gears and perhaps focus our attention on Nigeria, a country that I'm very familiar with because we come from the same continent, one that, of course, has a great level of opportunity in terms of its richness in natural resources. It's very buoyant and young population. But of course, like many other economies, following its most recent election outcomes, Haruna, we've seen a number of changes take place within the democracy of Nigeria. This has had economic implications. If you take a look at the depreciation of the Nigerian currency, heightened level of inflation, which then impacts on the livelihoods of Nigerians on the ground. I'm keen to get your thoughts and your reflections, firstly, on the most recent elections we've had in Nigeria and how this has translated into perhaps the shift in democracy that we've witnessed recently.
Thank you, Gugu, and thank you, everyone in the room. So just like you introduced, Nigeria is like the most populous country in Africa. We have a population of over 200 million. And
put those numbers into context, Haruna. So when I typically look at Netflix as a company, many of us might be familiar with it. Mm-hmm. If you look at their subscriber base, it equals Nigeria's population. So next time you think about Netflix and Nigeria, know that they have something in common.
Exactly. And that is why a lot of countries around Africa are looking up to Nigeria, actually, because we are almost everywhere, not only in Africa, but in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to democracy, I wish to state that this year we celebrated actually 25 years of uninterrupted democracy. That is from 1999 to date. And that is something that we've not achieved in the past, because ever since we gained independence in 1960, you know, we've had couple of military coups and interruptions in democratic process. So, but we've spent 25 years now under democratic rule, and we've had transitions from one democratic rule to another. We had expected, actually, in Nigeria to have our democracy more mature than it is currently. We thought we were going to witness improvement in terms of our elections. But it's not happening, actually. Sometimes it gets better, and sometimes it gets worse. Mm-hmm. Last year, we had a general election in Nigeria, and we have a new president. But then the credibility of the election was kind of questioned a lot. And we even thought that, okay, the election we had, or the past three elections we had in Nigeria, mm-hmm. was actually a more fair and free compared to the last one that we had. So which means, like, we have a kind of... we are like, I can't say moving backwards, but we are like not consistent in terms of improving our democratic process.
I think a lot of democracies can potentially relate to that, right? I guess even right here in the US, there was a time when that was the feeling on the ground.
Yeah.
So you're quite right.
Yeah, and so just like it's mentioned earlier, democracy actually needs to translate to, you know, people getting or having a say in what's happening, and also, you know, in the cost of living and so many other things that affect the citizens. But then Nigeria is wealthy. We have oil. We are the number one exporter of crude oil in Nigeria, in Africa, I mean. But still, when you look at the poverty level in Nigeria, it's really high, because we have more than 50% of the population are living below the poverty line. And insecurity, we have insecurity here and there. The previous administration was able to, like, suppress the activities of extremists,
yes,
in the northeastern part of the country, Boko Haram. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people are familiar with that, the activities of Boko Haram, which has led to loss of lives, you know, displacement of a lot of millions of people.
Yeah.
But still we are kind of back into another type of insecurity in different parts of the country, where we have, you know, like bandits or armed group men invading societies, killing people, abducting people, demanding ransom, and so on. So people are not really satisfied with the actions taken by the government, especially the recent government. After the president was sworn in last year, May 29th, he made some pronouncements which has greatly affected the lives of people in terms of economy and security. Nigerians have enjoyed, like, what we call fuel subsidy, but there has been so many debate about it, because it cost the government a lot of money. But then when he was sworn in, he mentioned in his acceptance speech that fuel subsidy is no more, it's gone. And from that day, you know, prices have multiplied, like, in fourfold. Like, we were buying fuel, like, say, a liter of petroleum at 80 naira, but now it's, like, around almost 1,000 naira, which has had great impact on people.
Exactly. I'm glad you mentioned this because it does put things into context for us to understand the realities of the livelihoods that of those who live far and wide across the globe. I do want to lean into a point that you highlighted, the fact that despite the fact that we've seen economic concerns on the back of the election results, but Nigeria's democracy is vibrant in the sense of open and active public knowledge. This is important because Nigeria's counterparts on the west of the continent have seen a number of coups take place. Think of countries like Niger and a few others. Let's talk about the importance of media freedom, its role in Nigeria, and how it has highlighted this importance around the stability of a democracy versus what we see other Western economies go through.
Yeah. So media, as we know, is critical in any country, you know, because of the role that the media plays. Just like other developing countries, Nigeria, you know, in terms of media freedom, we are not really ranked among the best. So we have moments where, you know, the government try to suppress the media. Recently, there was a protest or demonstration, a nationwide protest, you know, due to economic hardship. So in August this year, there was a protest from the 1st to the 10th. And during that time, you can vividly see, you know, the way authorities are really not happy with the way the media is working and a lot of effort to kind of suppress the media. A journalist lost his life during that time because, you know, there was some clashes and confrontations between government agencies, that is security agencies, and the protesters. And in Nigeria, actually, due to the economic situation, so it has affected the media industry a lot. Mm-hmm. The media industry was supposed to be independent so that it can report fairly on whatever is happening. But then, generally, almost, I can say 80% in Nigeria, the wages do not like meet up with the economic realities on ground. So most of the media or the media houses in Nigeria are kind of owned by either politicians or people that have, you know, businessmen, and they have their own interests. And then we have on the other side the government media, which is like the mouthpiece of the government.
Yeah.
So most of our journalists are really in the pocket of these politicians who have their own interests. So it kind of restricts the journalists from doing their job fairly and reporting accurately. So which has really, to some extent, tarnished the image of the media and made some of the reportings less credible.
And what you're highlighting, I guess, throughout this course of the conversation is really this evolution, not only of democracy, but also what it does mean in terms of media and media freedom and access to adequate information. One that will likely continue to change as time does go on, but of course does call for the strong, active participation of all citizens politically, but also to voice their thoughts and concerns around the economies that they're in. I want us to shift gears now to talk to another country on the northwestern part of South America, which often receives a lot of attention for its hiking trails, its beautiful beaches, but much like many of our countries that we hear from, and of course here in the United States, has also seen significant shifts and changes within its democracy, has also seen economic fallout on the back of these choices politically, but most importantly, again, a vibrant mix of media participants within that realm. Anna, I've kept you quiet for too long, so I'm hoping that you can share some insight with us, not only into your work and as a media representative and journalist in Peru, but how this in itself has also shaped the landscape in terms of the democracy in Peru.
Thank you, Gugu. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I feel very grateful for visiting so much of the United States. There are more trips ahead, but I am very happy to be in Iowa so far. You're right, Gugu. Like Peru, in the mind of many people, is a country they like to visit for hiking or because of their beautiful landscapes and delicious food and all that. But Peru has always, like Nigeria, has a very young democracy. We have a constitution that's turning around 24 years old. So, sorry, 31 years old. So it's a very young constitution. It's a product of a authoritarian government that we had in the 90s until the 2000s. So the early 2000s. It's a country that has a lot of problems with its political system because it's not as stable. We've had leaders who have manipulated the constitution or tried to also lead coups in the country. In the last government that was elected in 2021, we had a president, Pedro Castillo, who was elected fairly in democratic elections. But unfortunately, he decided to lead a coup in 2022. And this led to his arrest. He tried to escape to the embassy of Mexico, but he couldn't. Police cut his way. He was arrested, and he's now in prison. He's going to face a trial, obviously. Now we have a new president, which is Dina Boluarte. He's vice president by then. Dina Boluarte's government is also very questioned during the first weeks of her taking office, people were protesting against these changes in the leadership of the country. They protested because there were people who were supporting Pedro Castillo, or they protested because they were sick of everything. Mm-hmm. And these people were, sadly, some of them were killed during these protests. And there's no justice for them yet. There will hardly be. So it's very worrying and concerning in the country. Talking about the media, you're probably asking about that. We have a system that really facilitates freedom of the press. We have no problems such as real persecution of journalists or intimidation. We have some other, even though there are leaders and politicians who have used some laws in their favor to prosecute journalists. They do not go to the Rectification Act. Mm-hmm. They just immediately sue you for defamation. Wow. And that is some kind of intimidation, is some kind of censorship tool for them. It's a problem for journalists who really want to hold people accountable in the country. But so far, the media is not really under that kind of pressure. Mm-hmm. I mean, during these prosecutions, you can easily... nobody really gets sentenced for that because eventually those trials just get dropped off.
As other journalists in the room, I think we're breathing a sigh of relief that even though things do get quite tricky and difficult to manage, that perhaps there is no full prosecution for limiting media freedom, essentially. So there is an aspect that we can be positive about. I'm hoping that what you've gathered from the feedback you've heard here on the table is, number one, democracy matters. It matters because it plays an influence on the quality of life and livelihood that all of us as citizens in our respective countries get to experience. Number two, democracy changes and is changing. And that's through the influence of being active voters. And understanding that through the change and the shifts in democracy, there are consequences and outcomes. At times for the good, where institutions continue to live by a greater sense of integrity and following through on their mandates. And in other times where there might be consequences such as economic calamities, a lack of adequate support or management of capital from government or even the right policies. All of this sets the tone for what will also be happening here in the US, whether it's housing, managing immigration as a policy, how it is that we also factor in human rights and themes around abortion and the legalities around it. It all speaks to what it is that you as American citizens
in the United States will have an opportunity to share your thoughts and views on by heading to the polls. Just to double check before we go to questions in the audience, I'm keen to understand of the Americans in the room, how many of you are eligible to vote and if you've registered to vote by show of hands? Fantastic. Will you be voting on the 5th of November by show of hands? Fantastic. Exactly. Well, what you decide here essentially plays an influence and it has an impact on the countries that we represent as fellows, right? Understanding that there's a relationship we have being global citizens and participants. And that's perhaps the question I do want to ask my panelists and colleagues in the room as to what the US elections means for our respective countries. In a country like South Africa, we remain very key global partners. The United States has not only been a significant player in assisting South Africa from shifting from apartheid to a democracy, but in the current day that we stand in, we have more than 600 American businesses that are invested in South Africa and contribute to employment, contribute to the development of our country, and contribute to the vibrancy of the economy we have. If you see a Ford, know Amazon or Walmart, know that they are also invested in a country like South Africa. So the outcomes of the decisions that take place here do have consequences and are of significance to our global partnership. I'd like to come back to you, Anna, and maybe start there. When we take a look at the role and function that the US has in terms of its relationship with much of South America, how would you characterize it? But more importantly so, how do you see this playing an influence on the foreign policy relationship that the United States has with Peru, looking at the elections and the importance of the voting taking place in November?
Well, first of all, the United States is Peru's second commercial partner. It's after China, the most important country that contributes to the growth of the economy in the country. And we have a trade agreement since 2009. It's already been 15 years of disagreement. Obviously, in the first election of Donald Trump, when he was running for president in 2016, there was a concern because Donald Trump was talking about dropping some agreements. He was talking about NAFTA, he was talking about NATO, and he was talking about, all these kind of coalitions with other different countries. But in Peru, there was obviously a growing concern about how could Donald Trump or any government that was kind of talking about revising agreements or trades would affect the country. Obviously, that didn't happen during his government, which was good news for Peru. Another concern, and sorry, I want to talk about trade because the kind of products we mostly export to the U.S. are like our gold products in the country. Mm. We export blueberries, which is like one of the biggest products that we export to the U.S. We export asparagus. We have grapes as well, so probably you should... when you go to the supermarkets, notice where it comes from.
Yeah.
We export copper and gold and other products, but those are the most important ones. And the other very important topic for Peruvians that could have a very that could be very concerning whether a Democrat or a Republican president takes office is immigration. Peru has a very large group of immigrants in the country. We have around 300,000 registered residents in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's one of the first countries also in minds of people who want to leave Peru. So any different set of rules mm-hmm. could affect or could be concerning for people who are either living here already or planning to migrate.
And the important aspect to underscore there is that these are Peruvians who are looking to enter the United States legally and also actively contribute to the economy. So this is through structured controls and making sure that they are registered and, of course, acknowledged through the necessary systems. Something that is similar, though, as a theme, certainly does come to Nigeria and Nigerians, Haruna. There's a running joke, and Haruna will allow me, perhaps, if you will, to express this, that they typically say you can go anywhere in the world and you will find a Nigerian there. And that speaks to just how active Nigerians are in exploring the world and being global citizens. I'm keen to get your perspective, Haruna. The US elections, why does it matter to a nation like Nigeria? And how do you see the significance of the electoral outcomes influencing the relationship between Nigeria and the United States?
I can see whatever happens in America actually affects Nigeria. Just like you said, we are everywhere. And we have a very big size of Nigerian population in the United States. So, and we have trade relations. You know, we export crude. Nigeria is the largest exporter of crude oil in Africa, so we export a lot of crude oil. And we export crude oil to the United States. And also we import oil from the United States. We export some of the some agricultural produce. We import machineries from the US. And so many other trade relations that we have. So, and when you look at Nigerian economy, I could remember just a couple of months back, there was so much debate about the dollarization of the economy in Nigeria.
Yes.
Because we use US dollar a lot.
Yep.
So whatever affects the dollar, so much affects the naira.
That you'd rather trade and make purchases and using a US dollar versus a Nigerian naira. So that just speaks to the strength of
exactly.
the US currency.
Exactly. Currently, authorities in Nigeria are trying to, like, stop some schools from, you know, accepting fees using dollars, American US dollars. So, and we always compare our currency to the dollar. Which recently, because our naira has lost of value, you know, it contributed to the hardship that we are currently going, because we've lost our money has lost value. So when we talk about U.S. election, like everybody in Nigeria is keenly following whatever is happening. In the U.S., who's going to win? We know there are some policies in the past that have impacted a lot of people. I personally have friends who were living in the United States, but because of some policies, they had to leave around 2020, 2021. You understand? I think in 2020, beginning of 2020, there was a policy where Nigeria was included among the countries that, you know, its citizens were banned from coming into the United States, especially immigrants. You know, the countries receive immigrant visa. It had a lot of impact on Nigeria. And when you look at the issue of migration, which is just what I started talking about, it is a big issue currently, you know, in the build-up to this election, and it's going to play a very significant role. I could remember, you know, some of us were not happy with the way migrants from African countries and Haiti were described by the former president, I think, a while ago, in some years back.
Yeah.
So we are really keenly watching, and we have so much interest. And whatever happens is going to affect Nigeria. If policies in the United States leads to inflation or increase or decrease, it will certainly have impact on Nigeria's economy. And policies around migration would definitely have impact on Nigeria's economy.
Sure.
And also when you look at trade deals, you know, and relations, bilateral relationship between the United States and African countries,
yep.
it will certainly affect Nigeria.
Definitely. There is a particular trade agreement called the Africa Growth Opportunity Act, AGOA.
AGOA, yeah.
Yes, which is actually currently up for renewal in the year 2025. And in the month of August, several African leaders within their commerce divisions of their governments actually visited Washington, D.C. to ensure that there are active negotiations to understand how that agreement can be maintained, whether it's Nigeria or South Africa or Kenya exporting not only mining resources and mineral resources, but of course fresh fruits and grapes, much like Peru, but also understanding how America does continue to open up an opportunity for trade to take place by minimizing tariffs. Now, you did mention Haruna, the former president of the United States, and as we know, he is still a candidate, specifically as a Republican candidate for the presidential elections. There's been a lot of similarities that have been drawn to the personality traits of Donald Trump, to the leader as well within India, Narendra Modi. And I'm keen to get your thoughts on this one here, to paint a picture in terms of some of the similarities we might see in the personality dynamics ahead of the politics, but also understanding from a perspective of India, a buoyant economy, what the outcomes of the U.S. elections might mean for your home country.
First of all, very important economic insights from my colleagues from Peru and Nigeria. And India, of course, has a robust economic ties with the United States. We are, after all, a country of 1.4 billion, so consumerism is predominant. It's
so way more than Netflix, in other words.
Yes,
I just need to find another company to compare that to.
But I would like to address this question by delving into the political processes part, because numbers are very important, but so are political processes, especially when there seems to be a common playbook for many right-wing figureheads across the world. Coming to why American elections are very important to India, I think India right now is in a situation where a lot of people are attempting to preserve democracy. After all, we have a government under whose aegis there has been an invasion of civil liberties. The judiciary and the media appear aligned with the executive, and there is an attempt to undermine institutional autonomy, federal autonomy,